As my wife will tell you, I am not a man to shy away from the kitchen. I can follow a recipe. I can improvise to a degree. But like all aspiring cooks, I've had my fair share of culinary catastrophes. I've learned from my mistakes, and they are many. I remember one particular day when I was asked to cook white chicken chili. And my wife has her own recipe we like to follow for white chicken chili. It's not one that I'm familiar with cooking, so I don't know the ingredient list of that by heart, but all the same, said I'll go do it. And when I got home and got to cooking, realized I was missing something. I had all the ingredients, they're all in the pot, they're getting ready, they're cooking, but I'm missing some cream cheese. I'm thinking, okay, it's time to improvise. Let's see what we can do about that. So I get rifling through the fridge to see what I have there in order to find a substitute. And I find some yogurt. Some vanilla yogurt. And I think, no big deal. I mean, after all the seasonings I'm about to put in this thing, I'm going to put, so much chili in this, you'll hardly know the difference. It won't be noticeable. It did not pass unnoticed. Evidently, not all ingredients are created equal. Some ingredients are key ingredients. They are ingredients that don't have a good substitute. If you're lacking those ingredients, you still might have a dish, but it won't be very satisfying. It's true in the kitchen. It's true in the world. In our text today, the preacher will turn his attention to a few key ingredients that the philosophies of the nations lack. A few key things without which life will lose its luster. And we'll read all about it in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. If you will meet me there. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. We've been working through the book of Ecclesiastes for a number of weeks now. And what we've discovered is that this book is a coming-of-age tale. It's a story that a father is telling his son in order to dissuade him from seeking life through the vain philosophies of the nations. And the way that he goes about making his argument is through story. It's through story. The father tells him about a man who saw it all, who had it all, who tried it all, and a man that we're going to come to know as the preacher. And through this preacher, the father is telling the son, been there, done that, waste of time. There is no life there in the philosophies of the nations. And he's doing that so that the son will actually seek life where it can be found, by fearing God, by following his commandments. In this story, the preacher is undertaking a quest. He wants to go through this great experiment to find out what good can be found down here and out there, to determine exactly what the philosophies of the nations might have to offer him. And he begins by seeking happiness through pleasure and possessions, through wisdom and work. And he concludes that it doesn't satisfy, it doesn't last, it doesn't matter. And he moved to consider man's place in the world then. And he concludes that man's not free, man's not judge, man's not God. He's just a creature, so it would behoove him to acknowledge his Creator, to submit to the ways that his Creator is set to follow. In our text this week, in Ecclesiastes 6, the discussion is actually going to build on where we left off in chapter 5. So we're going to back up a few verses. We're going to get a running start into this thing. So look with me, if you will, at verse 18 of Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and we're going to move right into chapter 6 from there. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 18. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man, or I'm going to read it, when a man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and receive his reward and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them. for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. On the heels of considering the futility of pursuing happiness through status and wealth, the preacher concludes that that whole endeavor was, surprise, a waste of time. You know, contrary to their belief, he says they would be much happier if they just spent their days enjoying what they have rather than wasting their time trying to get more. Always trying to get more. And with that, in chapter 6, the preacher presses the point. What if they did have more? What if they had it all? All the things that we might call a recipe for success. All the ingredients we might think would constitute a happy life. What if the person lacked nothing that they desired? Well, it doesn't mean a thing unless God has also given them the key ingredient that they need to enjoy it. What is this key ingredient? What do they need? What are they lacking? If they have it all, what's the problem? Notice the preacher considers a man with riches, with property, with reputation. But in verse 2, we find that this man is troubled because of the activities of the NASB renders it a foreigner, you might call it a stranger, or simply another, somebody else. Somebody else is causing this man problems. He can't enjoy what he has because of them. What's this other person doing that's robbing our man from his happiness? Is he stealing from him? You know, is he pilfering the man's stuff? He's like, you know, I left my stuff here. I came to enjoy it today. Now it's gone. A foreigner's taking it. Is it the person who's next in line who's going to inherit his riches? So much like we saw in chapter 5, the man spends his whole life building up this great empire, amassing wealth and property and everything else, and he doesn't stop to take any time to enjoy it. And now, someone else is going to enjoy it. Is that what's going on here? There are some who have argued both of those points, but I think if you just keep reading just a little bit, the connection is going to become clear. Notice at verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he doesn't even have a burial, I say better the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility, it goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, and it never knows anything. It's better off than he. Even if the man lives 1,000 years twice and does not see good things, do not all go to one place? What is it that this man is lacking? What is the key ingredient that the Lord has withheld? Verse 3. It is satisfaction. Contentment. The man is not satisfied. What is the other person doing that's robbing this man of his happiness? Why is it disturbing him? Well, as best I can tell, verse 2, the phrase says that he enjoys them, he eats from them. The man out there is enjoying himself with the same things. He's got what he has. And since the other person appears satisfied, since he appears to have it all and be happy about it, despite the fact that the man has everything his heart's desired, he's discontent. He's looking over there and saying, why is he getting something out of this that I'm not? Apparently, you know, this kind of thing existed before the internet. Before Facebook and Instagram, where with a click of a button you can look and see how much better someone else's life is than yours. I mean, it certainly has made it worse. But it's nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. We look and see how much happier our friends, our co-workers are with their spouse, with their children or their grandchildren, with their car or their house or their vacations. And their apparent happiness becomes a source of discontentment for us. It's not really the stuff that they have that bothers us. It's the satisfaction that they appear to have that bothers us. That's what I want. Why don't I have that? And through that envy, jealousy, it becomes impossible to become satisfied because you're chasing something that is not there. The preacher says that kind of thing is prevalent out there. Prevalent among men. I see it everywhere. Everybody's looking across the aisle at his brother, and he's not happy because he thinks he's happy, and vice versa. It's prevalent. You're not content with what you have, and if you're not, then you have a severe affliction. You got big problems. That's not something that you can fix with a prescription. You got big problems. The things that people desire most, the things that they're most sought after, this man has. Like long life. You know, they become a curse though when you have lack of contentment. What good is long life if you're not content, if you don't see good things? The man who lives many years, verse 6, even 1,000 years twice over. He's worse off than a miscarriage if he doesn't see, determine what he has to be good in his life. If he is not satisfied with what he has, it's a big fat waste of time. Which, the fact that he's not seeing things obviously can't possibly be a statement about his lack of riches, wealth, or honor, since verse 2 says he's already got all those things. It's not that he's lacking anything in his life, anything his heart could possibly desire. This is Jeff Bezos. This is Bill Gates. This is Elon Musk. This is the guy who has it all. And yet, the preacher says those guys are worse off than a miscarriage if they don't see good things. If they're not satisfied. He says, I don't care if they live twice as long as Methuselah. That's a bad life. It'd be better not to have one at all. Why? Because length of life is not merely as important as quality of life. You know, the things that you think you want to live forever, or apparently have a million kids, he says, you don't want that. That's not it. It's better to have a short life, but one where you're satisfied. Quality of life, though, has everything to do with your disposition. It's not about your stuff. It's not about that person over there. It's about you. It's about your disposition. Now, for those who think it's about the stuff, I was considering the rich and the famous when I was preparing for this. How's their life going? I mean, we get more insight into their life now that we have the internet. Before, it was all very scripted, right? You see a TV interview and here they come. And it's really just another show, almost like they do on the film. Not anymore, though. And they can pick up a phone and just spill the beans at any time. We have a much better idea what's going on behind the curtain. But I was looking at some statistics. According to the 2017 U.S. Census, roughly 1 in 4 marriages end in divorce in America. You know, 23%. That's across the board. But the divorce rate in Hollywood, what do you think that is? That's 1 in 2. That's actually above it a little bit, 52%. That was in 2017. I don't know if the pandemic changed things. You know, locked down with one another, that thing might have skyrocketed. I don't know. But right now, it's at 1 in 2 at 2017, which tells me something. Evidently, being married to one of the most beautiful people in the world, with a high-paying job, living a life of luxury, does not lead to happiness and satisfaction. It's not there. If it was there, they wouldn't be so discontent. The people who have all of these things, they're not satisfied. It doesn't lead to happiness. In fact, from what I can tell, it tends to produce the opposite. More money equals more problems. It's a really confusing thing. The more we have, the more dissatisfied we come. It's not intuitive. I was reading 1 Timothy this past week. You know, Paul's letter to his apprentice as he's explaining how he wants him to go out and get the church together by appointing folks who are above reproach to get out the false teachers and to really clear the church's name from some of the slander that the Jews are spreading about. And I read this in the last chapter. This is 1 Timothy 6, verse 5. Listen to what Paul says. He talks about these men who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we've brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering with these, we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Evidently, Paul has been doing his devotions in Ecclesiastes. Because verse 7 comes right out of what we read last week. That's Ecclesiastes 5:15. You didn't come into the world with anything, you ain't going out with anything. And Paul's point, verse 6, be content. Or verse 8, be content. Or we see how he ends this thing, verse 17, instruct those who are rich in the present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope in the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. I wonder where he got that from. Enjoy what you have. It is the gift of God. Enjoy your lot. Interestingly, it would appear that this wasn't something that came natural to Paul, if you all know Paul's story. I think about his word, you know, we think of the prison epistles. I think of the book of Philippians where he's explaining to the Philippians how he can be joyful in his present situation. I know things look bad, but it's turned out for the better of the gospel. But listen to what he says in Philippians chapter 4, verse 11. He's talking about this gift. He says, I don't speak from want. I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances that I'm in. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret to being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And boy, have we, that's our favorite verse, isn't it? I see athletes with the tattoo. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Some of y'all know Dr. Klingler. He's one of my professors. He had a football background, but he was coaching some boys for a time. I think it was high school. And the boy had that on his shirt. You know, I can do all things. Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He says, Jojo, how much can you bench? I don't know, about 300. Okay. How much can you bench through Christ who strengthens you? About the same. Maybe that's not what that verse means, Jojo. Paul says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. When I look at this passage, it tells me that contentment is not a spiritual gift that God could just drop on people any more than obedience or patience is. Okay, if you want to know how to be patient, all right, wait. Yeah, that's how you learn how to be patient. You wait. I think of what the author of Hebrews says about Jesus in Hebrews 5:8. Jesus learned obedience through that which he suffered. That doesn't mean he was disobedient. He was without sin. But what it does mean is that he learned what it meant to obey by being put in situations where it would not be easy to obey. Where obedience would cause him to suffer. So he is learning about obedience. Likewise, in chapter 4 of Philippians, Paul says that he learned to be content regardless of the situation. He learned it. You say, Paul, how'd you learn that? Well, he didn't take a class on contentment. He didn't do a 7-week Bible study on contentment. The Lord just gave him times of plenty and times of want. And as he's going through these experiences, he learns to be content. He learns the secret. I tend to think of Paul, you might think of this poor little missionary running around the countryside. And he was poor, but he wasn't always poor. You might recall, I think of his missionary journeys. I think of the first one when him and Barnabas went out. Who paid for that? Paul and Barnabas paid for that. They paid through it through their work. That's what Paul says to the Corinthians. Did Barnabas and I, are we the only ones that don't have a right to pay for our ministry through working? Are we the only ones that are doing this thing out here? And that trip wasn't cheap. All right, if I'm thinking of the trip, it was over 1,500 miles. So if I'm thinking, well, you say, well, that's just a number. How far is it? That would be from Dallas to Providence, Rhode Island, one way. Or that would be like going from here to Frankfort, Kentucky and back, round trip. And it wasn't all on land. They had to go by sea for part of it. When you go by a ship, you got to pay somebody. It cost them 237 denarii per person. Say, how much is a denarii? Well, you remember that whole story about the woman who is anointing Jesus with a vial worth 300 denarii, which was almost a year's wage? So I think of a denarii, I'm thinking of a day's wage. So 2/3 of a year's wage per person they're paying just for their, we're not talking about where they're staying, what they're eating, none of that. That's just for the boat ride. It's coming from somewhere. He's paying for it. He knows what it is to have money. He also knows what it is to be without money because he experienced it. The Lord put him through it so that he would learn it. Contentment. So according to Paul, riches isn't the problem. What's the problem with riches? Look back at our text. Ecclesiastes 6, verse 7. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. Literally, the soul is not filled. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the soul isn't filled. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What does the poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires or goes after. This too is futility and striving after the wind. The wise man has an advantage over the fool. Okay? The poor man has an advantage over who? The man who has nothing has an advantage over the man who has everything. You say, how so? Because the poor man has something that the rich man doesn't. What is it? The poor man has enough. He has enough. He is content. The rich man, with all his getting, is still not satisfied. He never has enough. He wants more. He wants more. He wants more. He wants what his neighbor has. That feeling that he sees where he's so happy. He's so fulfilled in his life. How does he get it? Where can he buy it? He wants that. Not the poor man. The poor man has enough. I was thinking recently about the recession that's looming on our horizon. And it's coming. And, you know, some of the decisions that are being made, which are, you know, presently and will continue to hurt us, economically, they'll put the squeeze on us at the grocery store, at the gas pump, and that's not going to change for a while. And I began to wonder if that's really going to be a bad thing for our nation. Certainly, it's going to hurt the books. That's going to look bad. But for our nation as a character, for us as people, is that going to be a bad thing, or is it going to be a good thing for us? It got me thinking about a saying that y'all are probably familiar with by Mr. Mark Hopp. Hard times make strong men. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. Weak men make hard times. And so the circle goes and goes and goes. There's something to that. It's not just a matter, though, of strength and weakness when we're thinking about this thing. It's a matter of sensitivity. Now, there's a reason why Jesus says it is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. He's not looking for it, and he doesn't know he needs it. He has everything he needs. The only thing he's looking for is satisfaction somewhere. But it's not up there. It's hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom. There's a reason why I think of Paul when he's talking to the Corinthians. He says, look, the Lord chose you guys. And by the way, not many of you were wise. Not many of you were noble. Not many of you were among the who's who, were you? No, he's chosen the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He's chosen the foolish things of the world to shame those that are wise. There's a reason why it works that way. There's a sensitivity among those who know they have a need, who know that they don't know it all. You know, they at least have that much wisdom, Socratic wisdom, to say, I don't know everything. I know I need something. There's a reason for that. So I think about that. I think about what this time might offer our country as a nation. A time to step away from some of the foolish things. I mean, we're looking for satisfaction so bad, some folks think that the problem is their own body. I just get a new body. That must be the problem. I'm in the wrong body, you see. It's not that I don't have this or that. It's not that I'm lacking God in my life or community or family or whatever. I'm just in the wrong body. That's what it is. That'll fix things. It won't. So I think about that. I think of Blaise Pascal, who says there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of each man which cannot be satisfied by any created thing, but only by God the Creator made known through Jesus Christ. That's right. That is it. The philosophies of the nations, you know, the materialism that is so prevalent in at least our world, in America, that cannot fix things. That cannot satisfy. That cannot meet our deepest need. And that's by design. I think of David Wells. He says, we may now have everything, but none of it means anything anymore. The most we seem to be able to do is to take daily inventories of personal needs and then try to match up people, products, and opportunities with them. The irony is that this psychological hedonism, it's going after pleasure, in which self is the arbiter of life, is self-destructive. Not only are we betrayed, we betray ourselves. Meanwhile, we also pay the price of destroying all entrance in the transcendent, God, the sole source of genuine meaning in life. God, the supernatural, moral absolutes, these have become strangers in our modern secularized world. We're like Yeats' falcon, increasingly oblivious to the voice of the falconer. The center no longer holds, all is flung to the periphery where meaning is lost. We don't realize it, but we are on a self-destructive path. So long as we're pursuing self-interest, the end is self-destruction. So where does that leave us? Verse 10. Whatever exists has already been named, and it's known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He'll spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? We already know what man is. What is man? Man is dust. Man was taken from the ground. The Adam was taken from the Adama, you see. Man is dust, and because he knew better than his creator, to dust man shall return. He cannot argue with him who is stronger than he. Who gets to call it? Who gets to pick it? Who gets to decide what's good for man? Who knows what is good for man? Who knows what will bring him the happiness and the meaning and the contentment that he seeks? The thing which is created doesn't get to tell the creator how it's going to be. He doesn't know. The thing molded won't say to the molder, why'd you make me like this? Why'd you put me in this body? When it comes to knowing what is truly good under the sun, man lacks the key ingredient he needs. Perspective. He can't see it from the eyes of the designer. He doesn't know. He has to be told. He is here. And he has to be told why he's here, what he's to do, how will he accomplish it? It is through revelation. It is through God. The years of man's life are few. He spends them like a shadow, the text says. He barely knows the things that came before. He has no idea about the things that are coming after. Man can't tell you squat about tomorrow. He can tell you a little bit about yesterday, maybe. Nothing about tomorrow. And since he has no idea, the Father then asks the Son, through the preacher, why then should we look to man to provide the answer? If he doesn't know, why are you asking him? What could the nations possibly offer you through their vain philosophies? They are not equipped with the perspective that is needed in order to answer these questions for you, son. Who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime? How about the one who made him? That one knows. The one who has revealed himself to Israel. Is it not better to fear God and keep his commandments, that things might go well for you? To follow his ways as revealed by his word? Is it not better to seek life where it can be found than to try to trailblaze and find your own way? Now, that hasn't worked out for anybody in this story yet. Not one. And it's not looking good for the son that he might be the first. That's where this section is going to leave us then. So I think about this. I think about the futility of seeking satisfaction through any means other than God. Evidently, not all ingredients are created equal. I mean, what's true in the kitchen is true in the world. Just as not all ingredients are created equal, not all philosophies are created equal. It's not you get your truth and I get my truth, or that's true for you, but this is true. No. Not all philosophies are created equal. And all the philosophies of the world are lacking a few key ingredients. Every one of them. None of them have the answers. None of them can supply what man needs. And they're lacking them because they don't have a good substitute. They don't have a good substitute because there is no good substitute. You can take God out of your life if you want to, or you can try to replace him with some cheap substitute, you know, one that approves of whatever it is you want him to approve of, one that promotes whatever it is you want him to promote. You know, we tend to equate things in our neck of the world. I think of our Constitution. We're looking for, or even the Declaration of Independence. I'm looking for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I want freedom. And what freedom is, the pursuit of happiness, satisfaction, what that is to me then means no rules. Freedom must mean no rules. And no rules means no master, you see. So I need no master. Without God, I mean, you're going to have a life. It's not going to be satisfying because you're going to serve somebody, let me tell you. You'll either be a slave to your passions, a slave to your appetites, these things that, again, Kohelet tells us, you know, all that labor will be for your mouth, but that cannot fill your soul. Waste of time, son. Waste of time. You're going to serve somebody. Why not serve the Most High? He is the one, after all, who rules over the realm of mankind. He made the place, and he knows what's best for us.